Thanks for the introduction and invitation. And yeah, it's my great pleasure to be here today. And for once, I'm actually not going to talk about Fermi-Hubbard stuff because I thought it's time to also talk about some other topics. So I hope you're not disappointed. So let's get started. So what I want to talk today about is what you can do with data from your quantum simulator and how you can, after or while you're performing your experiment, make the most out of the capabilities that you have. And this is, of course, motivated by all the great quantum simulation platforms that we have now, like superconducting qubits, trapped ions, atoms and optical lattices, and neutral atoms and optical tweezers, and of course, many more. And I basically split up the talk into two topics. And the first part is work that was done in collaboration with the group of Markus Greiner here at Harvard. And so they have quantum gas microscopes. So basically what they do is, this is now a picture from Emanuel Bloch's group in Munich, but for me as a theorist, they all look the same and terrifying. But what they do is they have setups like these with which they basically create optical lattices in which they can then trap or like hold neutral atoms with which they can then in a very clean and tunable way simulate quantum many-body systems. So as I said, I'm a theorist, so let's make this very small and look at it. But what they do in these quantum gas microscopy setups is actually not only that they simulate these quantum many-body Hamiltonians in a very clean fashion and they know very well what Hamiltonian they are simulating and so on, but they also can take those Fock space snapshots. And what it really means is they realize a quantum system of interest and then they take an image. So this is actually really an image of the atoms in the lattice. This is actually from the Fermi microscope. So I guess that's the Fermi-Hubbard sneaking in here. And what you really see is a projection of your quantum state, a projective measurement of your quantum state. And the beautiful thing in a way is that if you take many, many measurements, if you repeat the same procedure again and again, all those snapshots will most likely look quite different. So basically this gives you a tool to gain a lot of information about your quantum state because you do projective measurements over and over again. And that basically gives you more than if you were just to measure, say, for example, the local density expectation values, because it gives you all the information about the fluctuations too. Okay, so what we looked at in this particular work now was the interacting Aubrey-André model. So that's a bosonic model. You have hopping, you have on-site interaction, U, and then you have a disorder potential. And this is something that they can naturally realize in this Aubrey-André model. It's basically a quasi-periodic potential, but given that the system sizes that we are considering now are small enough, it actually doesn't really make a big difference whether it's quasi-periodic or like a complete random disorder potential. And so what you see is you have your bosons that are hopping in this optical lattice. On each side, they see a different potential. And when they sit on the same side, they interact with interaction strength U. And the thing is now about this model and why it will be interesting for what's what I want to talk about is that it features some interesting dynamics. Because basically when you go to a very strong disorder potential in this 1D system, people think or believe that there is a MBL phase, so a many-body localized phase. Now there has been a lot of discussion whether this MBL phase really exists, but I think it's fair to say that within these small systems on the timescales that we can look at, we see localization if the disorder strength is very large. Now people have thought about this in theory in the last, I don't know, maybe 15, or even longer years, how to characterize many-body localization, how to determine whether the Hamiltonian you're looking at is many-body localized. And so what they say, for example, in this paper, and this is something that people looked a lot into, is that if you want to figure out where your MBL transition, so your diffusive to insulating phase transition is, then what is the most accessible quantity are the spectral statistics of adjacent energy levels. And so what that means is basically that as you tune your disorder strength from small to strong in this spectral statistics, you go from a value that is 0.5 something to something that is 0.39, I believe. And what this quantity really is that it basically you need to know the entire energy spectrum of your Hamiltonian. And of course, we can also look at that for the model that I was showing for. So this is the kind of prototypical MBL model. Here is like a XLC spin chain. This here is now the spectral statistics for the Aubrey-André model, so the bosonic system that I was showing earlier. The issue is now that while it is maybe most accessible if you can do exact tangleization, write down your entire Hamiltonian, it is actually experimentally extremely challenging because you would need to measure the entire energy spectrum of your Hamiltonian, which is not very clear how you would go about doing that. And of course, if you can do exact tangleization, that's fine, but ultimately the goal is to go to system sizes that are larger than that and to figure out a better way where we can then hopefully experimentally find this transition. There has been also a bunch of work regarding using machine learning and to detect this MBL transition, taking different approaches. I'm showing like a selection here. And these are really great works, but the issue is what they are using as inputs is again something that's experimentally extremely challenging. So here they're looking at entanglement spectra, which is really challenging to measure. Here they're actually using full eigenstates as input, which is basically means that you have fully diagonalized Hamiltonian. So if you have the eigenstates as input, you can also basically look at the level statistics, which is probably even cheaper than calculating the full eigenstates. Okay, so these are really nice theoretical works, but it's a bit far from those experiments that I have in mind. And so what they do is they typically can start from some initial state. So in this case, they would just start from a state where they have exactly one boson per lattice site. Then they do a time evolution. And after some time, they measure snapshots. And then they repeat that, of course, for each time that they're interested in, and also for different evolution times here. And so the first thing that we want to look at is what happens if we let the system evolve for a comparably long time. So we let the system evolve, we don't care about the intermediate time steps, we let it evolve for a long time. And the thing we are asking is, can we somehow from the snapshots alone, so without any information about the entanglement spectrum or the level statistics of the Hamiltonian, figure out whether there is some sort of transition or really drastic change in those snapshots that they are measuring. And so what we did then is to do the same evolution for different disorder strengths. So again, at strong disorder, we should be in this many body localized phase, or it should at least look localized as strong disorders, whereas it should just be thermalizing at low disorder without disorder. So what we did is we trained a standard neural network to distinguish snapshots at very low disorder from very high disorder. And then we sorted the experimental data in between. And I should mention here for full disclosure that actually in this particular experiment, the cycle times are so slow that it's extremely costly to take a lot of data. So for this particular case here, we actually trained on theoretical data and then sorted the experimental data after training on the exact diagonalization data. And what you also see, so the symbols are the experimental data and the lines are what you get for exact diagonalization. So you see this agrees extremely nicely. And what you also see is that we're looking at two different system sizes. And as you go to larger system sizes, it actually already looks like your critical disorder strength or a disorder strength at which something is happening is moving a bit to the right. So, and this is something that people also saw when they considered all these other things, for example, also these level statistics or these spectral statistics, that it's kind of tricky to make these finite size scalings in these systems here. Now, in this case, we already assumed that there is some sort of transition because we trained a neural network to distinguish the low disorder from the large disorder regime, which basically says we assume that there is something to distinguish in between. Another approach that was proposed in this work down here is to use confusion learning. And the idea of confusion learning is that we test whether there is actually some transition or qualitative change happening. So basically the main point here is that we don't a priori assume that there is something happening, but we check whether there is something happening and if yes, where it is. So the idea let me outline this and also see this paper. So they actually also looked at MBL systems in terms of entanglement spectra here. So the idea is if you, for example, in our case, tune the disorder strength and you have your data, which looks, say, blue in the left half and then red in the right half. So in this case, there would be some qualitative change in the middle. Now, if you try to train a neural network to distinguish snapshots in our case, given an arbitrarily chosen boundary line in here. So the disorder strength that I'm plotting here is the limit that we're putting on labels. So basically we start on the left here. So we basically label all as red now. Then we train the neural network to learn this. This will of course give us 100% accuracy because it's a very easy task to learn to just always call something red. But then as we move this label boundary further and further to larger and larger disorder strengths, something interesting happens. So first here, we see that this part now looks blue. So it is blue, but it has the same label as all the other blue snapshots in this part here, right? So basically the network, so if there is a qualitative change happening here, what the network sees is, okay, so this basically looks different maybe as this, but I'm still going to classify it as red because it looks the same as all of this half here, right? So this part here gets a red label, but it looks blue. So that's why this is called confusion learning, because the network is basically confused. And at this point, so this will be classified as red, which means even though we put our label limit here, right, which means that the accuracy here will be lower. I will repeat this over and over again. And as we come basically across the halfway point here, so we put our label limit here now, again, all these snapshots beyond this dotted line here look the same, right? They are all blue, which means that this part here now will be classified as blue, even though we put the artificial label red on it. So this will basically give us this shape. And then if we end up putting our artificial label limit exactly at the halfway point, the network will, again, like in the optimal case where we just have blue and red images, perform perfectly and get a 100% accuracy. So this is in the case where we somewhere within our parameter range have an actual qualitative change in our data. So optimally, it would be something like a phase transition or so. In the case where no such transition happens, of course, we would never get to this 100% in between, right? Because you would just be like, you would just go down, 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 and then up again. So it would just be basically a V shape. So with this confusion learning scheme, the main idea is, even if you like, if this was very confusing, ironically now, so the main idea is that if there is a qualitative change in the data at some parameter, then the accuracy as a function of your disorder strength will have a shape like a W. And if there is no qualitative change, it will have a shape like a V. So we can do that now for our data. And in particular, we can also do that for each time step. And that kind of shows you this in a bit more detail, because initially we always start from the state where we have exactly one boson per lattice site. So we basically start from a state that looks the same no matter what the disorder strength is, right? Because nothing has happened so far. We have just initialized the system in the exact same state no matter what the disorder strength is. So here we get this V shape, right? We start from a high value, which is blue. We go down to a low value. We go up again to a high value. Now we repeat the same thing as a function of time. And you see that as we go further and further in time, we actually see a faint W shape emerging, right? So if you go to very long times, you see that there is basically two minima emerging instead of just one minima, which gives us this W shape. So we can also take a cut at these late times, and you see that there is a faint W shape emerging out of this here. So this is really just cutting through this plot here. And so what we see is that somewhere in the disorder strength between 6 and 8, there is a maximum emerging, but it definitely isn't as clear a W shape as what we saw before. But now looking at this, we actually also see that we have a lot of information, right? Because we have this full time evolution. And initially, like in this transition plot that I showed you, we were only looking at like the last time step, but we actually have much more information, right? Because we have this whole time evolution that we were looking at. And so we wanted to look at this whole question of many body localization and what we can learn from our dynamics from a bit different perspective, namely whether we can learn thermalization. And the idea is now that when we start from a given initial state, that initial state has some energy. So basically how we can calculate that is just taking our initial state, which is this product state in this case, and calculate the expectation value of our Hamiltonian. And that cannot change during the time evolution because the energy is of course conserved. On the other hand, if the system thermalizes, it will develop to some thermal density matrix, which will be given by some effective temperature and then again the Hamiltonian. So the structure of this density matrix is quite clear. It has to be something e to the minus beta h. And the only question is what this beta is. And so since we know what the energy will be, we can fix this effective temperature that we should be thermalizing to if we are thermalizing by saying that the trace over h rho beta, so the thermal expectation value of our Hamiltonian, so the energy of our state, of our thermal state, needs to be the same energy that our initial state had, because that energy cannot change during the time evolution. And so with that, the thermal density matrix is completely fixed because we know our Hamiltonian and we have fixed our effective temperature. So basically we know we start from this initial state, we do time evolution under this Hamiltonian, and if the system thermalizes, it should thermalize to something that looks like this thermal density matrix. And what we do now is we train a neural network to compare the dynamics from each time step. So here's the times to this equilibrium state. So the equilibrium state always stays the same. And we input the snapshots from different time steps and train a neural network to distinguish those. And basically the performance of the network, so how well can it distinguish the snapshots from a given time step from this thermal equilibrium state, tells us how similar does this time evolved state actually look to a thermal equilibrium state. So that gives us basically some information about whether the state is thermalized or not. And in principle, so what people conventionally did to look at this question is to look at some observables, which is of course also fine to just look at some predefined observable, for example, local density expectation values and stuff like that. But in principle, if you have all those snapshots, the best way to answer this question, in my opinion, is to really compare the samples of snapshots that you have, because there might be some, for example, higher order correlation function or whatever in there that you don't think of comparing, but it still doesn't look thermalized yet. Okay, so we repeat that for all the times here. And what we then get is for each time step, we get the number of dynamics snapshots that is labeled as dynamics. So basically we ask how well can the network recognize a snapshot from the time evolution as such a snapshot from the time evolution, and how often is it confusing it with snapshots from the thermal state. And what you see here now is two different disorder strengths. You see this as a function of time. And what you see is that at small disorder strengths, so this is this lighter curve down here, it actually drops down pretty quickly. So really after something like one hopping time, you're already close to 50%. And 50% basically means that the network is making a random choice whether to call this now a time evolved or thermal equilibrium, which means that the state looks very much like a thermal equilibrium state already. On the other hand, if we go to a larger disorder strength, so this was already in the regime of this change that we saw earlier, so when we were looking at the transition, then you see that there is a small initial drop, but after that, it's much slower. There seems to be still something happening for this disorder strength, but it is much slower, and it really stays up here around 90% for all times considered, which is actually a very long time in terms of hopping times of this model. And now, of course, we can also look at that for all different disorder strengths. So these are now just two cuts out of this here. So here's the time, here's the disorder amplitude. And you really see that there is somewhere here a critical disorder strength, below which you get a thermalized state, in some cases, like for very low disorder strength, really early on. This time at which you see a thermal state shifts to the right. And after something like six, like a disorder strength W of six, you see that actually you can always distinguish your time evolved state quite well from your thermal state. Yes, so these were the two cuts that we saw here on the right. And finally, we can also make a different cut. Namely, we can cut through the time again at a fixed, so we look at a fixed time, kind of long time, and look at all disorder amplitudes. So that's what's shown here. And actually, this is quite similar now to the plot that I showed right in the beginning. Right in the beginning, I showed you this plot where we just looked at this one long time and compared very small to very large disorder and saw how the intermediate disorder strengths were sorted between those two extremal cases. And now here we are looking at each disorder strength separately. So for each disorder strength, we are asking how thermal does this disorder strength look when we compare it to a thermal density matrix. This means also for each disorder strength, we get a separate thermal density matrix, right? Because the Hamiltonian is different because you have a different disorder strength in there. So we also have a different row that we compare it to. So here we are looking really at each disorder strength separately, whereas in this plot we were comparing the different disorder strengths to each other. But the outcome, and that is not a big surprise, I would say, but it's a nice consistency check, is very similar. Because in both cases, we see that there is really some sort of transition happening. Here we kind of assumed in the beginning that there would be some transition happening. So here it's less of a surprise that you have to go somewhere from 0 to 1 if you go from left to right. In this case, we didn't put that information into. So in principle, it could have also been that it is down at 50% for all disorder strengths or up at 90%. But we again see that as you are at low disorder strength, you thermalize. And as you go to higher and higher disorder strengths, the network has an easy time to distinguish the time evolved state from the thermal density matrix. Now, one question that comes up a lot in this context is, of course, what can we learn from this? And I mean, there is some qualitative physical insights that we already can gain from this. And I also believe that it's becoming more and more relevant to check whether your system is already thermalized or not. But of course, it's always great to know what you should be looking for. So what is it that's thermalizing or not thermalizing? And for that, we actually looked a bit into interpretability, and we came up with Cole Miles, from Una Kim's group at Cornell. We came up with this network architecture which allows us interpretability. And the idea is that you basically start the same way as in a standard convolutional neural network, but instead of the normal nonlinear activation function, which would be something like the rectified rectified linear unit, which is very hard to trace back, right? So if you use a standard activation function, actually it doesn't really matter which one you use. We found that it's always very hard to trace back from your output what you were looking at. So what was important for the network? And optimally, from a Connell's metaphysics perspective, what we always want to know is which correlation functions are important. So all the information that we care about is contained in the correlation functions. You might have to go to very high order, but in principle, the information is in there. And so the question really was, can we figure out which correlation functions are important for the task at hand? And so the idea is now, so we need some nonlinear activation function in our network, because otherwise all we're doing is a giant matrix multiplication. But instead of using a nonlinear activation function that's very hard to interpret, we actually use something that's very physical and very easy for us to interpret. Namely, we just do an expansion in higher order correlation functions. So basically we train some filters, and from those filters, we can get arbitrary higher order correlation functions. The size of the filters, of course, restricts a bit to which order and correlation functions we can go. So that's something one has to carefully tune here. But in principle, that's just up to the training and the hyperparameters of the network, what we put in there. And so we basically train this network. Then in principle, if we have a translational invariant system, we would do a spatial average, which would be the easiest case. And in any case, we end up with just logistic regression in the end. So we basically get out correlation functions up to arbitrary order. We set some cutoff, of course, because we don't want to go to infinite order in our correlation function. So we will set some cutoff in the order of correlation functions that we consider. Turns out this is enough nonlinearity to give us pretty similar results in terms of quality of the network performance than what we had before. And then in the end, we use this logistic regression part here. So after training the entire network, to figure out which actual correlation functions were most important. Now, I don't actually want in this talk to go into too much detail about this, because we didn't even use this part so much here, because what we did was just to tune the order of correlation functions up to which we go. So that again is just a hyperparameter of your network that you can set now. And the question we wanted to ask is, as we do this comparison to the time evolved state, how much of a role does it play to take higher order correlations into account? So how does the network performance change if we go to higher and higher orders in our correlations here? So we don't even really care about which particular correlation functions we're looking at. And it turns out that this is quite interesting as a function of disorder strength. So what you're looking at here is different disorder strengths. So we're going from low to high disorder strengths again. We're doing the same task as before. So we are training the neural network to distinguish the time evolved state. So this is now at a long time to the thermal ensemble. And we are asking, how does the accuracy look as a function of the order of correlation that we take into account? So we look always at, in this case, we just restricted ourselves to order 2, 3, 4, and 5. So the first thing that's very obvious when you look at this plot is that the overall accuracy increases a lot as you go to higher disorder strengths. But this is just what I already showed you before, right? That as you go to high disorder strengths, the network has an easier time to distinguish the time evolved state from the thermal density matrix. So basically this big picture information is what we already saw. What we care about now is within each of these pictures, what role does it play to go to higher orders? So basically we down here, we take those same plots and look at the accuracy for the different orders of correlation functions relative to second order. So we basically use the second order correlation function as a bottom line, assuming that we always get a better performance if we take more correlation functions into account. And so basically the two here is always at zero. And for the higher order correlation functions, we basically ask how much of an improvement do we get if we take into account third, fourth, and fifth order correlation functions. And now the interesting part is actually that here it's not monotonic, because at low disorder strength, you only get a very small improvement if you take higher order correlations into account. You should also take into account that the scale here is, of course, changed. So here we go from 50 to 90% in our classification accuracy, and here we only go up to 4%. And so basically at small disorder strength and also at high disorder strength, so this is the first one that's really across from our transition point, we see that it actually doesn't really help us that much to go to higher order correlation functions. So it actually would be enough to consider 2-point correlation functions, maybe even 1-point correlation functions. Probably it would be enough to just consider the local density in this case. But in the intermediate regime, which is of course the regime in which this transition is happening, where you ultimately would expect some critical behavior, there we find that it actually does make a difference to take at least the third order correlation, here even the fourth order correlation function, into account, so that we really get a gain in performance if we take higher order correlation functions into account here. Okay. So this was all very experimentally motivated. I want to now highlight a bit why this looking at thermalization with this kind of framework might also be useful. I mean, of course, also experimentally, but this is now without any experimental data. So we looked at the transverse field easing model, which is like kind of the
one of the classic. Sorry, Annabelle, maybe can I ask a question on the previous slide just before we move on?
Yeah, of course.
I think I'm just, I just want to ask what the interpretation is here. So you're talking about when you say higher order, these are like endpoint correlation functions is what you're saying, right? So you get higher accuracy by including all possible or, you know, higher order correlation functions and in this intermediate regime. I guess I'm just asking, what's the interpretation there? Why do you get higher accuracy if you consider them?
Yes. So yeah, I should mention that it's always density correlation function in this particular case, because we only have like density snapshots. So, and the point is really that in principle, what I would think naively is that in those snapshots, you have access to all higher order correlations. And the whole point that I'm making all of the time is that you should use all this information about the higher order correlations that's contained in your snapshots to really make the most out of your measurement, right? Because you have all this information at hand, so you should also use it and not just look at, you know, expectation values of the local density. But from this plot, what it turns out is that there are some regimes where it actually isn't necessary to look at the higher order correlations, and where in principle, if you were to just measure your 2-point correlation functions, so this would be, for example, in the lowest disorder case or also the high disorder case, there isn't that much information contained. And for example, in the case of very high disorder, that's also somewhat easy to see because the system is more or less localized. And that means that in this density basis, basically nothing is happening. So you start from the state where you have exactly one atom per lattice site and just nothing is happening. And that means that what the network is looking here for is just, do the atoms still sit one by one on their lattice sites? Yes, they are. Okay, so job done. But in this intermediate regime now, it becomes more interesting because there, this doesn't seem to be the case. And there's really more information contained, and there is some structure in the higher order. So these are really like 3 and 4 and 5 point density correlations, which is kind of like a very weird object to look at. If you ask me to look whether those snapshots, like whether the system thermalizes, I would have a very hard time to come up with like several fourth order correlation functions which don't yet look thermalized, right? So that's basically the right takeaway here.
Right, and then one more point. And so then in the CNN, the order of the correlation function, do you have to pick it ahead of time? Is it like a hyperparameter?
Yeah, so basically here, you really, before you start training, you have to pick which order of correlation functions max. So basically you say, I know, like maximum fourth order, and then everything up to fourth order is taken into account. But you have to make that decision before training. So really what I did here is I trained for each of those like bars here. I did a separate training.
Got it. Thanks.
Okay, so now how can, like another perspective, how this can be useful is the following. If you look at something like the transverse field easing model, that's a model that it's kind of very well studied, and it has a lot of conserved quantities, and actually we know very well what they look like. So there is a whole like tower of those conserved quantities. The first one, of course, being the Hamiltonian, which is kind of clear that it's conserved. The other ones are these strange correlation functions. So these are these for different distances, you get this SXX and so on. And each of those is a product of the original sigmas in different bases. So for example, if you have SXX, then it would be a product of sigma X, then the sigma Z's in between, and then the sigma X on the other side, and so on. So the reason I'm highlighting this is in particular, so there are two things actually. One thing is that I find it quite interesting because the snapshots that we are looking at for now are all in the SZ basis. So we always measure in the sigma Z basis. So we always project into that basis. And so basically it's a priori not at all clear that we would have any information about something that's in the X or in the Y basis contained in those snapshots. The other thing is that these conserved quantities, of course, slow down the thermalization. And in principle, it's even worse than that. They not slow it down, but they lead to the fact we don't just thermalize to our normal thermal density matrix, but we have to thermalize to a state which takes into account all those conserved quantities. So what we did here now is to look at some initial state, which is kind of arbitrarily chosen. So in this case, we just start from a product state. We have some local superposition of up and down. And then we do time evolution, we take snapshots. So this is what snapshots would look like. So this is now for a 12-site system, and I'm showing like 10 different snapshots here and so on. So these snapshots are in the sigma z basis, as I mentioned before. And before we looked at this, we just compared to the thermal density matrix. And in a way, you can see this as in the thermal density matrix, you only take into account that your energy is conserved under time evolution with the Hamiltonian. But in principle, if you have a model like this, which has conserved quantities, you need to take those into account because you cannot thermalize to just thermal state of your Hamiltonian, but instead you need to thermalize to a state which has the same value of those conserved quantities. So this is kind of straightforward to see if you think about it, because if your Hamiltonian conserves this I quantity here, then this won't change under the time evolution, which means that even if the system like thermalizes as good as it can never change the value of these conserved quantities. And so what we're going to look at now is we look at this thermal state on the one hand and this generalized Gibbs ensemble. And here I basically made an approximation. So I took only the first two of those conserved quantities into account because the following point. So as you remember before, we fix our effective temperature in this thermal density matrix through this equation, right? We need to determine this beta, and we know the energy of the initial state, and we know that in the thermal state, the energy will be trace H rho. So we know that this equation must hold, and from there we can fix beta. Now, if we have more conserved quantities, we need to basically fix all those Lagrange multipliers here. So we need to fix lambda 2 and lambda 3, and of course, as before, beta. And actually, it's quite, so you basically have to really, be careful to choose those parameters correctly. I'm guessing that there might be some smarter way to do it, but in principle, if you just try to like numerically solve the system of equations, you have a hard time getting much further than two or three of those conserved quantities here. So that's just it. So basically we need to fix our Lagrange multipliers in this generalized Gibbs ensemble, and we considered here two different values of those. And we did the same trick as what we did before, now just for the thermal density matrix on the one hand side, and then this generalized Gibbs ensemble. And what happens in this case is, so what we're looking at is the time evolution again, as before. So this is the time, and we're looking at the network performance. And this is the same plot that you saw before, right? So at long times, you would expect your system to thermalize. So you start from some highly non-equilibrium states, so some product state here. So the network has an easy time to distinguish this state from your thermal state, your generalized Gibbs ensemble. And at long times, you would in principle expect your system to thermalize. So you would expect a performance close to 50%. And what we're seeing here now is that if you look at the no GGE, so that's just the normal thermal density matrix state, your network performance is still at around 70% here, which is quite a lot because, so it's still rather easy to distinguish snapshots from the time evolved state from the thermal density matrix. And the reason being that there are these conserved quantities that we didn't take into account in this thermal density matrix, so in this red points here. And I find this quite interesting because these conserved quantities are not even completely in the like sigma z basis in which we measure. So we project into one basis, and a lot of the conserved quantities actually happen in other bases, but still the network can tell those snapshots apart from a normal thermal state. But if you start to include some of those conserved quantities, so in this case, we included the first two, then you see that the network performance starts to drop. So actually this is maybe easier to see if we look at the difference. So this blue line here is really simply the difference between the red and the green line. And you see that at long times, you really get an decrease in performance of the network of roughly 10%. So there is really a significant difference in the performance of the network, whether you compare to a state where you don't take into account the conserved quantities versus if you take into account the conserved quantities. And what it really tells you is that even though you are kind of measuring in the sigma z basis, you don't even particularly look at those conserved quantities, the snapshots still contain information about the fact that you're not thermalizing to that state. And that is particularly nice. I mean, for the transfer speed easing model, we of course know the conserved quantities, but in other models, we might not know them. And then this might be a way to figure out whether we have all the conserved quantities that there are taken into account, or whether we should be looking for something that slows down our dynamics or that leads to the fact that we're not thermalizing to the state that we think we should be thermalizing to. Okay, so next I want to switch to a somewhat different topic. So this would be a good place actually if there are any questions.
I have a question. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, Annabelle, it's very nice. Maybe it's too ambitious question. For example, you took this Ising model in a transverse field. We know that if you do Jordan-Wigner transformation, things become easier. So can the machine learn that? Can the machine discover Jordan-Wigner transformation and tell you, for example, if you did not know that such a thing existed? I'm sorry if it's a too ambitious question.
Oh, that's a great question. So, yeah, I think it's a great question. I'm not sure how I would go about doing that, but in principle, I think there must be a way at least to find some information about that, because clearly it knows that there is some information contained in there, right? The fact that it's not just like, because, okay, so if you did the Jordan-Wigner transformation, you went to your fermionic picture, then of course, these conserved quantities become kind of easier, right? Because that's just like more or less free fermions that you're looking at. And so I think that general information is contained in there. So I think that's a great question. I'm not entirely sure how I would practically go about doing that.
For example, you said that multiple spin correlation functions become simpler because often string operators become just two fermion correlation function. So such clue, can it guide the machine to
discover? So, I mean, we didn't actually look into this with the CCNN. So with the architecture where we can take out the correlation functions, but that actually might be one way to go, right? That if you manage to extract which higher order correlation functions are important, then you maybe can from that trace back how you can make things easier again. So yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Sebastian, you have a question?
Oh yeah, just a quick question. What is the range of the correlations that you test? Is it always just neighboring, or do you vary the correlations that you test? Like the range of the correlations that you test?
Yeah, so I mean, for this stuff here with the transverse speed easing model, it's of course, everything is possible because there we don't use this CCNN, we just use a normal fully connected network. So there in principle, every arbitrary correlation function would be in principle included. With the CCNN, it basically, so this is now depicted for a 2D system, but in principle, it depends on the size of your filter that you choose in this step. And actually what we did here is to just choose a filter that's the entire system size, because we are only looking at comparably small 1D systems anyways, which means that in this case, we just looked at correlations across the entire system. But in principle, the size of this filter limits the range of the correlations that you look into. Of course, if you now are interested in something where you know that you have some longer range correlation functions, you can play some tricks where you can have larger filters or like funny filter shapes where you also like take into consideration points that are far away. But in principle, the choice of this filter here tells you how long range or short range your correlation functions can be.
Exactly. So what is the size of this filter in your case? What is you said it's the whole lattice? It's the whole lattice. What is the size of the lattice?
For this, where we use the CCNN, we only look at our, I think, 8 or 10 side systems. So it's rather small. And in that case, we just choose a filter that's as big as the entire system, so we can look at correlations across the entire system, which is also kind of necessary, right? Because if you go to fifth order correlation functions, then it's already like half the system that we have. So
yeah, okay. Can you? I was just wondering, like, the number of these filters that you construct explicitly for these features must be like, I don't know, millions or.
Oh, so sorry, that was maybe not so clear. So basically this, yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, I should have explained it better. So these filters here, we fix the number of filters in our network, and this is the same way one would do it in a standard convolutional neural network, that you basically fix the number of filters to some somewhat small number. And then the parameters of these filters are learned during the training of the neural network. So that means basically in principle, there is, like, of course, as large as the Hilbert space dimension, you could come up with filters which you don't want to do by hand. So that's kind of actually the task that the neural network does for us, to learn which particular correlation functions are important.
Okay, I thought the C and alpha X things, these are like predetermined, fixed.
No. Yeah.
Features. They
the particular structure of those correlation functions, which side is correlated with which, like within this correlator, that comes really out of the filter that we are constructing here.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. So then, let's use the last 10 minutes or so for a somewhat different topic, namely active learning. And this is something that we've been working on recently, and together with Hannah, Matthias and Fabian, all from Munich, and really Hannah did all of the work here. And so I'm very excited about this, but this is also very new results. Okay, so the main idea is that we want to do state reconstruction, and we basically want to do better. But let's start from the beginning. So we want to use, just basically as our workhorse, we want to use restricted Boltzmann machines. And this is now, of course, a bit like carrying owls to Athen, because this is kind of the group where all of this RBM stuff is happening. But let me just briefly recap the general idea. So when you want to reconstruct your quantum state, you basically take measurements in different bases. And to train with like a restricted Boltzmann machine, we start by choosing some reference bases, for example, the Z bases, and then we want to reconstruct our target wave function. So we introduce this RBN wave function. So this is a restricted Boltzmann machine, which basically consists of a visible and a hidden layer. There is no connections within the layers, but the layers to each other are all to all connected. And the way this has been set up is that there is basically one network that is trained for the amplitude and one that is trained for the phase. And this is also kind of the part why we need to choose a reference basis, because the amplitude and the phase of this state are trained separately. And so how one now goes about this is that we train a restricted Boltzmann machine on some measurements. So we basically, in this case, this would really be what I looked at, the entire time snapshots of the quantum state, but in a collection of bases. So far, everything that I showed you was in the, like, first in the density bases of these bosons, which can have higher occupation numbers, and then in the Z bases of the spins of the transfer speed easing model. So it was always those data sets of measurements, but just in one basis. And to really reconstruct the state, to get information. So if we just choose the Z basis as our reference basis, then everything that I showed you just gives us information about the amplitude, but not about the phase. So to get phase information, we need to measure in a collection of bases. And now the question that we were wondering is, can we find a smart way to choose those bases? Because in principle, if you have a system of n qubits or spins or whatever you have, then in principle, there is 4 to the n basis configurations, right? Because you can put like an identity, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. So even if you lose the identity, there is a lot of different basis configurations. And of course, in each of these basis configurations, you then probably also want to sample a bunch of snapshots. So you don't want to go through all of them. And that's where the idea of active learning comes in. So typically what we did so far, and what's kind of the standard way of doing things, is passive learning. So this guy just has this box of training data that's labeled, and he learns from that. In the case of active learning, the idea is that the active learner can request labels for samples. So basically you start by learning something, and then instead of just providing a preset set of measurements, you can figure out which measurement is actually the one that will give me the most information gain. And in our particular case where we want to reconstruct the state, the idea is as follows. So you take some initial measurements and they already give you some information about your quantum state. And with this information, you already might know that some basis configurations give you more information than others. And that means, so if you were to completely kill it out and do exponentially many basis configurations, you of course end up with the same result. But if you say you are working with some experiment and they say, okay, Annabel, we are going to do 1,000 basis configurations and that's it. So I better choose those 1,000 basis configurations in a smart way. And a priori, if I don't know anything about the state, I of course cannot choose them very smart, in a very smart way. But if I start to take measurements and I have some information about my state, then I can go ahead and figure out which next measurement configuration should give me the maximum information gain. Okay, so what we do concretely is the following. We have to start by choosing a reference basis. And that actually is already the first step where this active learning part comes into play, because it's not so clear which reference basis is the best. So in our case, we look at only global rotations. So we basically get a few samples in one global basis. What I mean by global basis is that we do all in X, all in Y, all in Z, and so on. So we choose a few of those global bases. For now, we just choose X, Y, and Z, and we get a few samples in each of those bases. So for each basis, say, for example, the global X basis, we then train several restricted Boltzmann machines, which have different random initializations to learn the state. And we repeat that for the, say, for example, X, Y, and Z basis. And then we do a query by committee. So we choose the basis with the smallest variance between our committee. So the committee are the N different restricted Boltzmann machines. They are all trying to learn the same state from the same data. And to choose a reference basis, we really just ask them, which basis do you agree most on? Okay, so that gives us, in the first step, the reference basis. So now we know in which basis basically we will measure our amplitude here. But that was only the first step. And then in the second step, we now of course need to measure in different basis configurations to fully determine our state. And therefore we repeat the following until one of those two conditions is met. So either we have some preset accuracy that can be, for example, if we know something about our state, then it can be to reproduce a given observable or something like that. If we, on the other hand, have a state where we don't know anything about it, then we might just cut off when the maximum number of measurements is reached. So we sample at the chosen basis. So for example, we start by the reference basis that we chose in the step before here in the first step. We train again as like a ensemble of restricted Boltzmann machines to learn the state from the measurements that we have. And now to choose the next basis where we really want to gain more information about. So this is now not anymore about finding the reference basis, but about finding the basis in which we need to measure to figure out the details of the state. So we basically, what we do is we train our committee, or like our ensemble of restricted Boltzmann machines, to learn a state from the data that we have so far. Then we sample from those RBMs in different bases. And out of those bases, we choose the one in which the restricted Boltzmann machines disagree most. So we choose the one where there is the most confusion between the RBMs, which means that there is the most information to be gained. Okay, so to be concrete, what happens if we do that? So what you see here is we're trying to learn the GHC state on 9 qubits. So it's a 9-qubit system. We prepare just some GHC state and we are trying to learn that. And here is the number of training epochs. And we are showing so this is 1 minus the rescaled fidelity here. So we basically want this number to be as small as possible, because the fidelity is just because we know we prepared the GHC state. So we compare to the GHC state again. So that's basically something that we can do here for benchmarking, because we know which state we have. And the other thing is the Kullback-Leibler divergence, which basically tells us how close the learned distribution is to the sample distribution. So how well do our restricted Boltzmann machines reproduce the distribution of the measurements that we took? Okay, now the two things that you see here, the blue lines, the different blue lines, are the different active learners. So this is our ensemble of restricted Boltzmann machines where we apply this active learning. And the green line is the baseline. Now the baseline we define as follows. We take the exact same number of overall measurements than for the active learning, and we take the exact same number of basis configurations, but in this case, we choose the basis configurations randomly. So this gives us really what we would get if we had the same resources. So we have the same number of measurements, the same number of basis configurations, but we don't use any knowledge about the state. Okay, now you might wonder what this kind of funky structure in here is. So basically, at each of these spikes here, we start the training from new, because this is basically, these jumps always happen when the learner, so the active learning algorithm, requested samples from a new measurement basis or from the same measurement basis, so from when there are new samples added to this active learning cycle. And then we again start our restricted Boltzmann machines from the same initial random initialization. So we basically, and the reason we do that here is because we want to treat the entire ensemble of measurements equally. And if we just continued learning from where we were before, we would kind of, in some sense, favor the early measurements over the later measurements. But what we want to do is really to treat our entire measurement set equally. So in principle, you could also get similar performance if you just continue training from here. But that's the reason you see those spikes. So it always spikes up because we should start again from some random initialization. And then it drops again because it learns with the samples that it has at hand. So during this time, it's just training. And then here it spikes up again because it requested new samples. So we added new samples to the training pool. And what we find is, and so this baseline is just what you get if you really from the beginning took the same number of measurements, same number of bases, but randomly chosen where you end up here in the end. And so what you really see is that your fidelity is much, much smaller if you do this active learning. So basically we were hoping, so what we need to get is, we need to get under this baseline that we won't do worse than this baseline is kind of a pre-given, because I mean, it won't be worse than random sampling, or that would actually be really bad for our algorithm. But what we really find is that we are much better. So we are much below this baseline that we would get if we just chose our basis randomly. And the other thing that I actually find quite nice is that, so this green bar here, that's the spread. So there we trained, I think, 4 restricted Boltzmann machines on this randomly chosen basis configurations. And you see that there is actually quite a large spread between those 4 in the performance. Whereas the active learners, even though they are also like 4 RBMs that are randomly initialized, but they all yield very comparable performances. So you get much better fidelities, and we also get a much lower spread in the performance between our different RBMs. And so maybe one thing that I should mention is that the Kullback-Leibler divergence, which is basically, so this is what we're trying to optimize during training, right? But this is actually a bit tricky to look at here in this particular case. So you see, of course, here we end up also with a value that's comparable or lower for the active learner compared to the baseline, but it's a bit misleading to look at the Kullback-Leibler divergence for the for the actual, so basically this gives us different information than fidelity, because the Kullback-Leibler divergence tells us how well do the RBMs learn the state given the data that we trained them on. And now the thing is that we trained the baseline on different data than the active learner. So they both could very well reproduce the data that we put in there, but the data that we put in there contains very different, or could contain very different information. So the Kullback-Leibler divergence we need to optimize. That's what we're using for training the RBM. That's important. And that's basically just the question, what does the RBM make out of the information that we give it? But this fidelity, or in other cases, physical observables that you might be interested in, where you, for example, if you have an actual experiment and you realize some model and you know that you should get some value for a given physical observable, in case you cannot just calculate the fidelity. So that's where the actual question come in. How well did we choose the measurements and how much information is contained in the data set on which we train those RBMs? So these two, I'm just saying that these two plots contain somewhat different information, and the real gain, so what I'm really telling you, the real gain is here in this fidelity. And we looked at this for a bunch of different states. So let me just finish by showing this for a bunch of different states. So what I showed you, so this is now for 5-qubit states. What I showed you was the GHC state for 9 qubits, but again, so we're comparing here again the 1 minus the rescaled fidelity. So we want this to be as small as possible. And you see that for the different states that we consider, the active learner is always as good or better than just the baseline. So here we, for example, look at a state where you have equal probability for all different configurations. And here we look at actually some very trivial state where the performance in both cases is very good, because we just look at a state with all spins up. Okay, so with this, I think I overstretched the time already a bit. So thanks for your attention, and I'm of course happy for any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the audience? Just feel free to speak up.
Can I ask something, if that's okay?
It's okay.
Can I ask something about the stuff on thermalization earlier? First of all, thanks a lot for a great talk. I just wanted to ask, so when you're comparing your sort of non-thermalized time evolved state to your thermalized state, and you're having the neural nets kind of, you know, spot the difference, you're looking at these density snapshots. But I was just curious, I mean, are there systems where you could have thermalization in the densities, but no thermalization in other observables? And is that something that, I mean, especially in the case of the generalized Gibbs ensemble, where there are other conserved quantities, I guess, yeah, could it also be that, well, you're feeding this density information to the neural nets, but there's other information that would be helpful here as well. And if thermalization happens with the density observables, maybe they don't with others. So I guess, yeah, just a general question on that. And maybe entanglement entropies could add additional information here too. But those are just, yeah, some, yeah, basic questions.
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, that's kind of the optimal combination of the two things that I was talking about, right? Because like in an optimal algorithm, you would combine the thermalization question with the active learning question, right? Where you would be like, okay, now I measured all the time in a density basis, but maybe I should look into another basis, or like some weird combination of basis configurations to figure out whether it's thermalizing. And that's actually also, let's see. Did it just close this? I think I just closed this. That's fine. Okay, there we go. So when I showed you this, I kind of already like hinted a bit at this, right? That I think the outcome would be even more striking if we were not to measure only in a sigma z basis, but if we were to figure out that we need to measure in this combination here. So yeah, I think it would be really, really interesting to combine this thermalization question with measurements in different bases, and then optimally, of course, kind of automize how to find which basis is optimal. to measuring.
Cheers. No, thank you. That was great. Honestly, I'm, yeah, I think more into the thermalization stuff. And it was very, very interesting, especially because I've been looking into some entanglement entropy stuff and trying to understand more about many body localization. So thank you very much.
Yeah, actually, that's also like an interesting question, right? Because like if you look at these MBL systems and the entanglement entropies, then there is one part, this number entropy, right, that is contained in the density snapshots.
Right.
And that should come out, like out of the snapshots that I'm looking at, this number entropy that's in there. But that's not enough, right? In principle, so that does not give you the full von Neumann entropy. So in principle, to get the full entanglement entropy, you need to play some tricks. And there is some entanglement information contained just within the single basis. But yeah, I think it would be definitely very interesting to figure out whether there was something to be gained by measuring different bases.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I have a short question, Annabella.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, a very nice talk. So you talked about many body localization at the beginning and how machine learning learns it. So I wonder, what is the status of one-body localization from machine learning point of view? For example, can machines tell about mobility edge and will they predict the existence of mobility edge in three dimension and absence in two dimensions and so on?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I don't know a lot about Anderson localization, to be honest. I know that, for example, like here, like this is for many bots and for an interacting system. But I mean, here they find that there is some dependence of the critical disorder strength on the energy within the spectrum. So there they found that, for example, and I believe it, so, and what I was saying earlier, that the, like in this density snapshots that I was looking at, the number entropy is contained. And for Anderson localization, that's all there is. So basically what you get if you thermalize versus if you're Anderson localized is whether you're, entanglement entropy just stagnates and this stagnation is captured by the number entropy, and this number entropy is captured in like density snapshots. So in principle, I would think that what I was doing should work even better if you look at Anderson localization, but I don't know what has been done there also in 2 and 3D. I don't know.
Thank you.
Arun?
Yeah, thanks for a very nice talk. I had maybe a question which maybe most people know in the audience the answer to, but I somehow don't know, which is, so if I give you a snapshot of some closed system, which is that whose correlations look thermal, for example, start from the kind of quenches you talked about, so consider them chaotic Hamiltonian, evolve with it so that you go to some thermal, some state which looks locally thermal. And this is one state. Now let's compare it with a state which is a ground state of some gapped Hamiltonian, which also has exponentially decaying correlations. And if you did not know that, I mean, obviously the simplest way to distinguish them from theoretical point of view, just look at entanglement. One is area law, other is volume law. But if you did not know that this is what you should be doing, and if I just give you these pictures, is there some unbiased approach where someone who had never heard the notion of entanglement entropy, that machine be able to learn that either machine can perhaps learn von Neumann entanglement entropy, like something like that, like in some interesting way, or maybe there are some other functions which are nothing directly related to with various moments of local traces of density matrices, but something completely else, which machine can learn. Has this question been answered so far? Because this is a very, I mean, obvious question which comes up all the time, distinguishing gap ground states from thermal states. What's the current status of this?
So one thing that you should always keep in mind is that when you do machine learning for anything, the machine will always find the simplest possible thing. So basically, if you show the network something that is, I don't know, like a ground versus thermal state or whatever, and you're hoping to, you know, identify entanglement patterns, like volume versus area law or whatever, then most likely the network will find some much, much simpler observable that's different between those two data sets. So in that sense, it's a bit tricky to directly look for entanglement properties, I would say. Like if you just have snapshots, and then, so the question that you then should really ask is, how does different entanglement properties manifest itself in those Fox-based snapshots? Mm-hmm. And that's the only question that you can answer from this data, right? So the only thing you can answer is there anything that looks different, for example, whether I have volume versus area law entanglement? And one thing that, for example, for these many body localized systems, people have seen, not with machine learning actually, but with hard-coded correlation functions, is that you can actually see this log growth. Like if you do a quench and you look at the dynamics, and then you, in the MBL system, you get this log growth of the entanglement entropy. And that, so something that looks very, very much like that, you can actually figure out from a configurational correlator. So that's something where you basically, you cut your system into two, and then you basically ask, what is the correlation between the different configurations in just two halves? So that's kind of a bit complicated observable, but the information is all contained in those snapshots. And they find that in this quantity, they really see this log growth. So that's one example. I'm not sure if there is a general thing like that with which you can, for example, distinguish area versus volume loss. I'm not sure if there is something.
Maybe a quick question from me. In the last part of your talk, when you talk about the RBMs, when you're choosing a reference basis, okay, so maybe even more general, do you have any intuition for whether it's easier to learn an amplitude versus a phase in that RBM structure? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think it depends a lot on what your state is actually. So actually we tried around with one like ground state of some many body system, and we found that it would always choose like one particular basis as reference basis, and then afterwards it would always only request samples from this reference basis again. But then later we figured out that that was because there was just no phase information in that state. And so the network figured, okay, there's no phase information, so I just rather measure the amplitude very well now. So, but my impression is this really depends a lot on the state that you're looking at. But I mean, I guess you guys probably also have a lot of insights into the RBM training.
Yeah, I don't know. No, thanks. That's I think that's a great answer. Anything else? Any other questions from the audience? If not, maybe we'll stop the official recording here and thank Annabelle once more. Thank you very much.